This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Calls for the resignation of Virginia Governor Ralph Northam over a medical school yearbook picture are growing louder. The story is getting worldwide attention. AP's Ben Thomas has the latest.
A small group of protesters gathered outside the governor's mansion in Richmond Saturday morning, adding to a chorus of calls for Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's resignation.
I am deeply sorry.
Northam issued an apology last night in a video statement.
That photo and the racist and offensive attitudes it represents does not reflect that person I am today.
But one Virginia Democrat who has spoken with Northam tells the Associated Press the governor does not believe he was actually in the picture. The official, who is not authorized to speak on the record about a private conversation, says Northam has been calling state lawmakers to try and gain support and has no immediate plans to resign. I'm Ben Thomas.
New street demonstrations for Venezuela's self-declared interim president Juan Guaido are taking place today. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said last night in Miami, it was time the world recognized Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate leader.
There can be no bystanders in the struggle for Venezuela's freedom. The United States today calls on every nation to recognize Juan Guaido as Venezuela's president and take the side of freedom.
Buenos días, pueblo de Venezuela. Soy el general de división Francisco Esteban Llanes Rodríguez.
A high-ranking Venezuelan general today announced his support for Guaido. Francisco Esteban Llanes Rodríguez, the director of strategic planning for the Venezuelan Air Force High Command, said he would no longer support Nicolas Maduro. Maduro is counting on his military to back him in his bid to stay in power. It remains to be seen if General Llanes' decision will lead others and help tip the balance of power toward Juan Guaido. He not only disavowed Maduro's socialist government, he called on other members of the military to defect. This is VOA News. President Trump says the United States is suspending its compliance with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, signed by President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in the 1980s. In Moscow, an echo on Russian TV from President Putin. Here's AP's Karen Shamus.
We will respond quid pro quo, Putin said. Our American partners have announced they were suspending their participation in the treaty, and we will do the same. They have announced they will conduct research and development, and we will act accordingly. President Trump had earlier accused Russia of violating the treaty by developing banned missiles. Moscow has strongly denied any breaches and accused Washington of making false accusations in order to justify its pullout. Trump said in a statement that the U.S. will move forward with developing its own military response options to Russia's deployment of banned cruise missiles that could target Western Europe. I'm Karen Chamas.
As Warren Levinson reports, some arms control experts are clearly worried by these INF developments.
Kingston Reef of the Arms Control Association says the president is right when he says Russia has been violating the INF treaty, but withdrawing from it rewards Moscow's misbehavior.
I think Russia would certainly prefer that the United States withdraw so that Russia could place the blame for the treaty's demise at the feet of the United States.
Reif concedes persuading the Russians to come back into compliance is a long shot, but he contends there are diplomatic and even military tools available that the Trump administration is declining to use. The result, a possible renewed missile race in Europe that leaves everyone less safe. I'm Warren Levinson.
Pakistan says it will have fenced off nearly half of its border with Afghanistan before the spring fighting season there. Pakistani military officials say the pace of the massive project has been accelerated to guard against the threat of terrorism from Afghanistan if the United States goes ahead with a widely anticipated military drawdown. President Trump is showing new signs he's ready to ignore the wishes of congressional Democrats on the issue of a southern border wall. He called the bipartisan talks on reaching a budget spending agreement a waste of time and strongly suggested he plans to declare a national emergency to get the $5.7 billion of wall funding he is demanding. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is insisting there will be no money for a southern border wall in any new spending agreement from Capitol Hill. Just how much he talks about all this in his Tuesday night State of the Union address, meaning President Trump, to a joint session of Congress, is the new guessing game here in Washington. And Iran's media are reporting that gunmen shot and killed a member of the elite Revolutionary Guards and wounded five other people on Saturday. It happened at a paramilitary base in southeastern town of Nikshar and is being described as a terrorist attack. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clawton in Washington.
The appeal chamber instructed the registrar to contact the states and enter into agreement with them to accept Mr. Gbagbo and or Mr. Blegoudet on their territories and to enforce this condition.
Belgium accepts to take former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo following his acquittal and subsequent release by the International Criminal Court.
The rule of law requires that you should go through that due process and you should follow that due process. If you follow that due process and the Chief Justice is found liable and there is a punishment that is meted out, a sanction that is meted out for it, that's fair and good.
The trial of the suspended Nigerian Chief Justice will resume Monday.
It's laughable and I find that statement to be very novel, especially coming out of one who is the vice president of the country. The police is working around the clock, flashing out all the sides that are in disguise, being associated with all these violences.
And the Malawian vice president accuses the ruling party of using violence in an effort to rig the upcoming May elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo would be living in Belgium following his acquittal at the Hague-based International Criminal Court, ICC. The Belgian Foreign Ministry announced Friday the administration in Brussels has agreed to take the former Ivorian leader and his aide, Charles Blegoudet. They were ordered to be conditionally released by the ICC Friday. To learn more about the ICC's decision by the former president, I reached Fadi El Abdullah, spokesperson for the Hague-based court.
The appeals chamber of the ICC decided that conditions are to be imposed on Mr. Laurent Gbagbo and Mr. Charles Blegoudet upon their release to a state willing to accept them on its territory and willing and able to enforce the conditions set by the appeals chamber. These conditions are imposed to protect the integrity of the process and will be precised and indicated in a written judgment that will be made available later today. The appeal chamber also instructed the ICC registrar to identify and enter into arrangements with such states to accept Mr. Gbagbo and or Mr. Blegoudet on their territories and to enforce these conditions. And meanwhile, the ICC registrar also may make appropriate and necessary interim arrangements regarding the release with conditions pending the conclusion of agreements with these states.
With the conditions that the court imposed, does that mean that if the court needs them, they have to return to The Hague for the process to continue?
The conditions will be indicated in the written judgment that will be made available at a later stage.
So why is the former president not being allowed to return to the country? Because he was arrested in Ivory Coast. He was brought to The Hague for trial. Now that the judgment has been made, why is he not being returned to Ivory Coast?
Well, first, the acquittal is not final because there is still a possibility for the prosecutor to appeal the acquittal, and thus the proceedings might continue. And that's why there is a need to protect the integrity of the process and to respect the conditions that are set by the chamber. The conditions for now are not known. They will be known when the written judgment will be filed and on which state will be willing to accept Mr. Gbagbo and or Mr. Blegoudet and to enforce these conditions. This will depend on the discussion with the states.
As it stands now, what is next in this process of the trial of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo?
Well, there are two things here. First, the acquittal. It was decided by the trial chamber, but the prosecutor may appeal the trial chamber acquittal decision once the written version of the acquittal decision will be filed. The second thing is the conditional release that the appeals chamber has ordered today and for which the appeal chamber instructed the registrar to contact the states and enter into agreement with them to accept Mr. Gbagbo and or Mr. Blegoudet on their territories and to enforce this condition.
After this news came out, a lot of people have been raising concerns about where to release the former president. They are saying that the decision to release him to a third-party state or state means that the court has made a political decision rather than a judicial decision. How do you respond to that?
There is no indication for the time being where he will be released, that will depend on the agreements with the states that are willing to accept Mr. Gbagbo and or Mr. Blegode on their territories and to enforce the conditions that are set by the appeals chamber. This will depend first on the observations that will be given by Mr. Laurent Gbagbo and Mr. Blegode about their preferences, where would they prefer to be released, and second, on the acceptance of the states.
What is the time period within which the prosecutor can appeal, and how long will this process last?
There is no appeal possible for the decision on the conditional release, but there is still the possibility of appeal against the decision on the acquittal. And for that, the prosecutor may appeal that after the trial chamber files a written version of its decision. And for the time being, we don't have a clear deadline from the trial chamber when the decision in writing will be filed.
What is the message here, as the court has made a decision about releasing the former president? What is the message here?
I think the appeals chamber was very clear. Mr. Gbagbo and Mr. Blegode have been acquitted by the trial chamber. They can be released, but with certain conditions to ensure the protection of the integrity of the process, because the process may continue if the prosecutor files an appeal against the acquittal.
Fadi El Abdallah is the spokesperson for the ICC. He spoke with me from The Hague. Meanwhile, appeals judges at the ICC have granted conditional release to former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo and his former youth minister Charles Blegode a month after the two men were acquitted of crimes against humanity charges. For VOA, Lisa Bryan has more from Paris.
The appeals chamber has considered carefully both the oral and written submissions of the parties and participants in the appeal.
After 7 years detained at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo and ex-youth leader Charles Blegode are free men. But there's a hitch. Presiding Judge Chile Eboué Usuji read out the unanimous verdict of the five-judge appeals panel.
The conditions set out in the written judgment are imposed on Mr. Gbagbo and Mr. Blegode upon their release to a state willing to accept them on its territory and willing and able to enforce the conditions.
It's a small victory for ICC prosecutors after the court's stunning acquittal of both Gbagbo and Blegode last month. Judges said the prosecution's case was exceptionally weak in trying to link the men to election-related violence in Ivory Coast in 2010 and 2011 that left roughly 3,000 people dead. Both ICC prosecutors and the chief lawyer for the victims, Paulina Masida, had argued for the two men's conditional release. Masida warned they presented flight risks and said their unconditional release might impact victim safety.
Victims remain very concerned about the possibility of a commission of further crimes and attempts to compromise the integrity of the proceedings if the defendants are released without conditions.
Gbagbo's lawyer, Emmanuel Altit, unsuccessfully argued that conditional release went against the very principle of his client's acquittal.
La position de la défense part d'un constat simple. La liberté est un droit essentiel.
He said liberty is an essential human right, and Gbagbo should be freed since he was acquitted. Last month's acquittal has intensified criticism of the ICC, which has convicted only four people in the nearly 20 years of operation. One of them, former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba, was later acquitted on appeals. Critics say the court is ineffective and overly focused on African cases. Supporters note the so-called court of last resort is probing other regions of the world and say the court has insufficient means to realize a daunting mandate. In the Ivorian case, the West Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch, Jim Wormington, faults ICC prosecutors for giving an appearance of being one-sided. He said they failed to simultaneously take on both sides of Ivory Coast's post-election violence, which pitted Gbagbo's supporters against those of current President Alassane Ouattara.
Right from the outset, they decided to sequence the prosecution so that they prosecuted Laurent Gbagbo and people from his side of the conflict before they started to prosecute people from the Ouattara side.
Ivory Coast is gearing up for presidential elections in 2020. Ouattara says he will not run for re-election, but Gbagbo supporters hope the ex-president will run for another term. But Gbagbo faces a possible 20-year prison sentence if he goes home, and it's not certain he's covered in a general amnesty announced last year. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The Nigerian Court of Conduct Tribunal will resume the trial of the suspended Chief Justice Walter Onugen Monday. The suspended Chief Justice is accused of maintaining some accounts that were not declared as part of his assets before coming to office. President Muhammadu Buhari replaced him with Tanko Muhammad as the country's interim Chief Justice. But the Nigerian Bar Association rejected the suspension and embarked on a two-day court boycott on January 29 and 30 as part of an effort to pressure the government to follow what the group says is due process. For more about the group's concerns, I reached Peter Usuru, president of the Nigerian Bar Association.
Well, it was very successful. Between, I would put it at 85% success.
So the rest of the 15, what happened?
You know what happens in some of these things? You find government trying to break ranks. They sometimes introduce, in a society like ours, they introduce ethnic, religious, political affiliations to attempt to break rank. And personally, I believe that there might have been those type of things. But it was a negligible number that actually yielded to such divisive issues. The greater majority, they were very, very bullish. In fact, in some cases, people were asking whether we should go beyond the 2 days.
Well, I was about to ask you that since the trial of the suspended Chief Justice is still ongoing, is the Nigerian Bar Association going to take additional steps?
Well, you know, there has been this statement that has been issued while thanking all the members for complying with the boycott resolution of the NBNNEC. We also reaffirmed our position and called on government to do the needful, what it ought to do, and stop the trial. We're still discussing internally. A committee was set up, and that committee is also meeting. And we will respond as appropriate in the coming days.
Well, recently, the Information Minister, Lai Mohammed, said the Nigeria Bar Association doesn't have a case since the suspended Chief Justice failed to declare his assets, and that when he was confronted before he admitted his wrongdoing. So you should allow the trial to continue, and if he's found not guilty, then he could be restored to the position of the Chief Justice. What is your take on that?
First of all, we are not talking about the liability of the Chief Justice. We've made this very clear. The issue is not whether or not he's liable. The issue is there is a due process, and the due process requires that the National Judicial Council be the ones who should entertain this complaint first, make a determination on it, and it is only after they have made a determination, and if that determination is against the Chief Justice, that the prosecuting agencies can take it over from there and carry out their prosecution assignment. That is the case of the NPA. Now, the essence of that due process is to protect the integrity of the judiciary, ensure that it remains independent, and also separate the functions from the executive. And that is all we are saying, that the rule of law requires that you should go through that due process and you should follow that due process. If you follow that due process and the Chief Justice is found liable, and there is a punishment that is meted out, a sanction that is meted out to it, that's fair and good. We shouldn't preempt that. But rule of law requires that you follow a due process. You follow the process that has been stipulated by law.
Members of the international community, including Paul organizations or monitoring groups, have expressed concern about this process. What is the take of the Nigeria Bar Association on international pressure, as some people say, should be brought bare so due process is followed?
I look at the presence of international organizations beyond the prism of the Chief Justice's issue. The international organization and the international observers are primarily here for the election. And I have been asked that question, do I consider that it is necessary they should be here? And I said, yes, I consider that it is necessary that they should be here. The essence of their being here and helping in the monitoring is that it also reminds are the ones who are in power in Nigeria, our governors, our rulers, that we belong to an international community and that there are some basic conducts and behaviors that are acceptable if you wish to belong to that committee of nations. And that by itself acts as a check in regard to the behavior of those who are in power. So from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense that we should have the international observers. In the course of their doing the observation, then it's understandable also that they might comment on matters that could affect the election. And the issue in regard to the Chief Justice of Nigeria is potentially an issue that could affect the election. And it's understandable that they should have their comments and they should make their opinion and their thoughts known. That is not unusual. That is a universal standard that we're all used to in all countries.
Peter Osoro is the president of the Nigerian Bar Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The Malawian vice president has accused President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika and his ruling party of using violence and intimidation against opponents in the run-up to the May general election. Vice President Dr. Saulos Chilima, leader of the opposition UTM, says the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, is also using violence or terror as a ploy to rig the elections. For a government reaction to the accusations, I reach Malawian Information Minister Henry Musa.
It's laughable, and I find that statement to be very novel, especially coming out of one who is the vice president of the country. He should be the first one to appreciate the peace and tranquility that is prevailing in Malawi right now. He himself should have been the first one to point at all these and associating these violences with the party, which he is failing. The police is working around the clock, flashing out all these sides that are in disguise, being associated with all these violences, so much so that there is no evidence whatsoever. This other guy, he claims to be a member of his party, to have been assaulted. We have again and again requested them to explain really what happened. See, where the two clash, there must be a reason why that has happened. But believe you me, these claims that he talked about during his press briefing or press conference are laughable. In fact, I made a statement where we had to come out with a government response.
There have been recent instances where supporters of DPP are alleged to have attacked opponents of the president. How is the government addressing this concern?
Well, the concern is being addressed by all stakeholders that are involved in the forthcoming tripartite elections. You see, I like it when you say it's alleged. It's all allegation. The ruling party cannot be beating its own people. The ruling party is the one that has put institutions in place, police included, to really police and arrest all these thugs, and they're being arrested. If you allowed me time tomorrow, I would have given you a list of those that have been arrested under the guise of DPP. When, in fact, it was just a shirt of DPP that was put on this side, paid money to create all this havoc, just to tarnish the image of the Democratic Progressive Party.
There have also been allegations that security operatives and the police are being used by the ruling party and by extension the government to intimidate and harass our opponents ahead of the election. How are you addressing this, Mr. Information Minister, from the government level?
I challenge your source of information, and if it's sincere to come up with such evidence of such statements that are really made or aimed at steering problems for Malawians. There is nothing of that sort where government can be sponsoring police, to be causing all these problems at its own people. Where on earth can that be happening?
So, Mr. Information Minister, let me ask you. A lot of people have been questioning why this president and his deputy appear to be on a different playing field. How effective is the government being run since, the president would have to delegate a duty to the vice president to perform? Local media reports say the president has not been delegating tasks for the vice president to undertake. So corruption is there because the vice president, they said, is collecting salaries per month without doing any work.
Yeah, but to begin with, let's talk about the question of delegation. What is it that was under the office of the vice president? Reforms program, which is now under office of the president cabinet. In fact, this function moved when he was in office, 100% member of the party, DPP, and 100% member of the government and 100% vice president. That function went back to the office of the president cabinet and the support staff. The other function was to deal with the issues of disaster management. Okay, all this is now under the Home Affairs, so we're calling it Homeland Ministry and Security, which is now dealing with issues of disaster management. So these are the two functions that were there. And as and when, please, the president could be a trip here, a trip there to go and represent the president. But remember, it's a collective responsibility. We have 20 members strong. Without him, we're 19 members strong. So much of the delegated functions are being split or spread or divided among itself.
Henry Musa is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The opposition in the Ugandan parliament has accused the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM party, of plotting to amend the constitution to provide for the election of the president through the electoral college system. Under the new arrangement, the party with the highest number of legislators will automatically assume the presidency. This would imply that Ugandans will not be able to participate in the election of the president, but the powers will be vested in a small caucus of the party that would have more legislators. My colleague Douglas Mpuga read Charles Mwanguye Mpaji, bureau chief for the East African newspaper in the Ugandan capital Kampala, to find out more.
Yes, they are, and yes, I've heard about them, and they appear to be credible. But the party caucus and its secretariat have been mooting some ideas. This is coming in as the country prepares to see what government is coming up as proposals for broader constitutional amendments, especially as regards electoral laws or provisions within the constitution. So yes, the NRM members, apparently a small section of them, have been mooting the idea that the party could consider going collegiate in deciding who becomes their president, adopting a parliamentary system.
Why would they at this point prefer to have a parliamentary system instead of the current presidential one?
They haven't clearly articulated that at the moment, or at least information available to the public is still relatively limited. But the thinking would be that in 2021, President Yoweri Museveni will be offering himself for his sixth elective term. The constitution was amended at the end of December 2017 to remove age limit, which was the remaining hurdle to his continuing in power. But they can't guarantee that the ground will remain in support, as has been, to guarantee him an outright victory if they went for universal adult suffrage. So the thinking that they could resolve that using their strength of numbers in parliament is a consideration that might be coming from that position.
You talk of their strength in parliament, given their numbers, and they have, as you say, or before, amended the constitution to favour their party. Is this a foregone conclusion? Should they want to go ahead with it?
In the current circumstances, you'd say yes, because the NRM clearly controls an overwhelming majority of members in that parliament. And Douglas, you might want to interest yourself in the fact that the amendment of the constitution under what was known as the Raphael Majezi Bill was done through parliament when what everybody expected was that such a weighty amendment to the constitution should have been sent to the voters to make a decision on. So they have experimented it before, and they have succeeded in using parliamentary majority to amend the constitution. I would not be surprised if they used it again, and I would also not be surprised that they will get the numbers, because their numbers are clearly above, including dissenters within the NRM itself. They would still have a majority to pass an amendment they want to pass.
Given that they have already amended the constitution to remove term limits, age limits, now if they go ahead to convert to parliamentary system, what will then be left of the current constitution?
Well, they have argued before and said that the constitution is a living document, so it needs to be adjusted to fit the circumstances of the time, which can be something one can laugh about. But The constitution remains the shadow of the document we had promulgated on October 8, 1995.
Charles Mwanguya Mpaji is the bureau chief for the East African newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Mozambican parliament called for the arrest of former finance minister Manuel Chang so he could be extradited to the United States following his recent arrest in South Africa. The former finance minister is alleged to have been involved in a debt scandal with the suspected involvement of senior Angolan political officials. Meanwhile, X-Africa, a specialist intelligence company, recently conducted an investigation to explore the role of the Angolan political elite in the Mozambique debt scandal. For more about the inquiry, viewers Joao Santarita reached Robert Bessling, Executive Director for X Africa.
The report is based on source commentary from well-placed individuals in both Mozambique and Angola, as well as those involved close to companies in various other jurisdictions. We are very confident of the intelligence that's provided by these sources. And, of course, much of their commentary is also backed up by documentary evidence.
Now, Dr. Bessling, the other question I would like to ask you is, I read the report, and obviously the similarities with the agreements with Mozambicans are striking. But is there any evidence, actually, that anybody in the Angolan government, like the former vice president or even the present president, took commissions, for lack of a better word, from these companies, or that the agreements were inflated for the services provided?
I think that is the main point of the publication of the report. The report and our consultancy, X Africa, does not try to accuse anyone of any wrongdoing, etc. I think that is the key point. What the report tries to establish is that a number of key defense procurement deals were made by the Angolan government in 2015 and other years with exactly the same entities which were involved in very circumspect and controversial dealings in Mozambique, which, according to the U.S. jurisdictions and various other investigations, are considered to be fraudulent. Therefore, the main point of our investigation of the report is that, in fact, it's almost a prompt to the Angolan government to try and consider releasing further information on the scope and structure of these procurement deals and to assure that these deals, in fact, were transparent indeed in full accordance of law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My last question then is, have you had any reaction from the Angolans or from anybody else from the companies involved?
At this stage, we have not received any reaction from the Angolan government or from the companies involved, no.
Former President Eduardo dos Santos had any knowledge of these deals?
We do not have any evidence that former President dos Santos had any direct knowledge of these deals. However, the individuals very close to the presidency at that time, including then Defense Minister João Lourenço, as well as the Vice President Manuel Vicente, seem to have been very close to Privinvest and Proindicus procurement deals at that time. So it would almost come as an inferral from that the presidency itself would have had knowledge from this. But again, I have to stipulate there is no direct evidence of this.
Robert Bessling is the executive director of X Africa. He spoke with viewers Joao Santarita from London. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are hearing from Janet featuring Tufan with Mama Africa. It will be followed by Mao Sama featuring Handstone with Yokote. KC featuring Timaya with Erima. Tendai Shaba with Zazikulu and Juliana Kanyamozi. And Bushoke Uzendi Mbali.
Come baby, sumari kwa nyundo nigaongee. chikitana naitumia hiyo kote kiona kwa juu chini meza mia hiyo kote
sungura nipe karoti marage sijazoea
hiyo kote
na kunja kote na pandisha mori na chichimea oh yeah baby baby
ukitoka kuoga nitenge ya moto moto Tinga moka kitenge, tutoke mtoko ah, Boda kwa boda tutembe, chocho kwa chocho Tena nikichoka ni bebe, mikwako mtoto aye Rafuzi ya pemba rangi rangi pare Nyule kihindi chambi chambi na Cheza rafuko na bambi Kitanda naichumia Iyo kote Kiona kwa juu Chini meza mia Iyo kote
Sungura nipe karoti marage sijazoea
Iyo kote
Na kunja kote na pandisha mori na chichimea
when they got time for the big things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They wanna put you in a bad place. Put you in a bad place. They wanna see you in the worst way. See you in the worst way. No time for the small things. No, 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 no. Only got time for the big things. Yeah.
mamacita, te amo. Love you without you, honey, always for me. Señorita, te amo. Love you without that booty, don't for me. Puede que seas mi aninga. Girl, you know that I love you. Oh, oh, oh. Igawungu, igawungu. Anything that you want me to, girl, I go do for you. Yes, mi amiga. Girl, I just won't be your friend. Ya won't be na kupenda. Baby, please don't leave.
Agachani, oh my, agachani, oh my, agachani.
Well, you just heard Nathi featuring Vusi Nova with Kanjani. And then before then, you heard Singer with Teyamo. That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Amdun, and our engineer for today, the ever-friendly Nashwan Kale, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you overtake a leader, you break your neck. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.